Hello, everybody, and welcome to Masterclass this evening, July 20th, 2023. So glad to have you guys. We have a great list of presenters this evening. It's a long one, but they're 15 minutes each. Hopefully, we will get through them. It should be a lot of fun. There's a lot of different topics, so it should be really fun to listen to them and see what they've come up. We will start with Ricky tonight. Are you ready, Ricky?
Oh yeah, I'm here. I'm ready.
All righty.
Okay, so let me share my screen. Let's see. Okay. Think last time you said if I click the presenter here. There we go.
Yes. All right.
Okay, so good evening, everybody. My topic tonight will be on computer virtualization. And let's get started. So virtualization, when I was doing some research on this topic, it was speculated that it started in the mainframe days in between the 1960s and 1970s by IBM to introduce a timeshare concept so that users can share compute resources. This promoted efficient computing and data management. In the IT cybersecurity world, virtualization is a program that allows you to run multiple operating systems and applications on top of an existing hardware, like your PC or a server, for example. Virtualization is seen most commonly in the server environment because of its hardware. And basically you could run multiple instances of different operating systems on that said hardware, which in turn leads me to my next point, which it can help reduce hardware costs and emissions. You also could save electricity and promote a smaller carbon footprint, which I thought was kind of cool. And to reduce the risk of compromising the host system, IT and cybersecurity agents would launch a virtual machine to analyze a suspicious file or capture malware for a deeper analysis. So, to summarize that, instead of launching that on a real machine, they will basically launch a virtual sandbox, so that way the malware or whatever they're trying to do is isolated from the OS, which I thought was neat as well. So according to VMware, at a minimum, you will need the following: either a variety of Windows operating systems, which could be Windows 8, 10, 11. On the server side, you could have Server 2012, 16, and 19. On the Linux side, you could have Ubuntu, Red Hat, Debian, and Fedora, just to list a few. A compatible 64-bit Intel x86 or AMD 64 CPUs that was launched in 2011 or later. At least a 1.3 gigahertz or faster core speed processor. And at minimum, you need at least 2 gigs of memory, but having more is recommended, so that way it does not bog down the host operating system. So this photo here, this is my custom built PC, and here's some of my specs here. And as you can see, I have exceeded the VMware's minimum requirements. And what's also cool about it is that it is a custom liquid cooling kit, which means that my system won't run hot, basically. This system is primarily used as a workstation. I also game on this machine, and this will make a good VMware box as well. Let me see. And so here's my references here. And I'm going to give you guys a live demonstration on how to create a virtual machine. So let me just exit out of this. All right. So here's the VMware Workstation Pro. This is the paid version of VMware. I think it cost me like around like $200 for a license, which is not too bad. And this license is for life. So there's no subscription and stuff like that. It's tied in with my system here. So to create a virtual machine, you want to click create a new virtual machine. Typically I will use this is the recommended setting. So I'll just stick with this. Although if you're feeling froggy, you could go ahead and click the advanced setup, which will go through like of the hardware. So for now, I'm just going to use typical. They'll click next. And I have an ISO copy here on my system. Let me just make sure that's correct. Yeah, yes, it is. Okay. Oh, and this is all my VMs I have here, the ISO files, and along with the client. So in this case, we'll go here, open. And it's Windows 10 for this demonstration. Oh, and one thing to note here, these ISOs I've gotten straight from Microsoft. So that's the best way to grab the ISOs. If you do a Windows, if you don't do Linux, it's the same process. I will go to either Ubuntu, for example, and grab the ISO from there, and you can always load it from here as well. So I'm gonna click next. Yeah, that's fine. You can also change the name if you want, but I'll just keep it as default. I am going to change this path here, so that way we could do, let's get a kosher here. Let me see. And this PC. Virtualization. Yep. All right. Here's where you could choose your disk size. This is the minimum for Windows 10, so I'll just leave that as default for now. If you want to select this option, this will make it easier if you want to move the VM from one workstation to the next. But in this case, seeing that is just my system here, I'm just going to do it as a store, as a single file. Click next. Now, by default, these options will come up here, but let's expand that. So here's your memory. As you see, my host system is 64 gigs of memory. So I'm just going to put this as 8 gigs for now. The processors, as you saw, I have a 24 core processor. So I'm just going to make this a quad core. There we go. So that's a quad core. These, normally I don't mess with these here, but most modern systems now should have in the BIOS the virtualization enabled by default. If not, what's going to happen is once I click on close and try to launch the VM, I will get an error saying that I'll have to go into the BIOS and enable the Intel VT option there. So leave that this for now. And then for the network adapter, NAT is basically we are sharing the host IP. If you want to do host only, this is a private network, or if you want to bridge to your network, you could just select bridged, but in this case, I'll just keep it on NAT for now. All this here is by default. I actually don't really have a sound card, so that's fine. Printers. I actually just found out that this will not pick up your home printer, so I'll just leave this as is, and then we'll just let that use my monitor for now. So we could click close. So it saved the settings I want, and I'm gonna click finish. Oh, and this is gonna power on by itself to make it easy. So Click finish. It's going to create the disk. And in fact, let me just full screen this for you guys. All right. Oops. There we go. All right, so obviously I speak English. I'm in the US and in the United States time, so I'm gonna click next. Install now. I don't have a key, so I'll just click I don't have a product key. That's fine. This is just a virtual machine, so I'm gonna do Pro 64-bit next. I accept the terms. Next, we are going to do a custom install, and you can see this is the disk we had just made. So we're going to click next, and then it's going to go through this process. It should not take that long actually. It should take about, I would say, 10 to 15 minutes tops. So. Plus my storage where my VMs are stored is in a SSD, so I guess so it shouldn't take long. If this was a hard drive, it'll be a different story. All right, we'll do a reboot. And then it's going to walk through its steps from there. Oh, and this could minimize as well, so it doesn't really get in the way of anything. Actually, if I pull up, all right, so I'm gonna do US next. Yeah, we're in the US. Nah, I don't want to add another keyboard.
Are the resources limited for this VM version?
No, actually, let me just drag this over. No, you can't see it here. I have to minimize this.
I know my students have trouble with that all the time. If they're using the wrong kind of computers to make their VMs in class, you know, sometimes they can't do 2 gigs.
Right. So let me see. So right now, this is my usage right now. So I'm using like 20 gigs, but I've allocated 8 gigs right now, so 20 gigs is the 8 gigs plus what my host is using right now. So as you can see, I have my PC isn't slow whatsoever. So.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do personal use. we'll just do an offline account. It's just a VM limited. Just do master class 7. Password is password. Yeah, sure, why not? Let's see. That's fine. It's just a VM. That's. Let's see. That's the Windows 10 thing. That's fine. We'll do that as is. Accept. Skip that. Not now. This box will eventually grow big because my monitor is kind of huge, so it's gonna pull the drivers and such. All right. Maybe later. All right. And here we are. This is the VM. I could go anywhere. I could do, you know, import stuff. Let me just back out of this for a minute. Let's see.
So if I have this right, you have Windows, and yeah. You added a Windows VM.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
So right now, yeah, because if I was to minimize this, I'm running on top of my machine right now.
So is your machine Windows 10 or 11?
I am running Windows 11 actually.
Okay. All right.
Yep, and that's it. Awesome. This is the VM right here. All right. Does any questions, comments?
No. Excellent job. We do it in class. We do it with Lubuntu, which always reminds
Lubuntu,
me of
yeah,
Lubuntu. It's like, you know, Lugal. I don't know. You got to know the movie that I'm talking about right now. But anyways, it always reminds me of that. But yeah, this is great. This is great to show, and I might end up taking that out and showing my students. Because they just don't get it, but this is great. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Mika, you got a question or a comment?
Yeah. So when you are using the VM and you make some profile configurations and changes, mm-hmm. is there an instance where that would be lost when you log out of the VM? Or is there, like, what situation would you lose your profile or have to basically start over?
Oh, so Let me share back my screen real quick, actually. Let me see. Oops. So when I was playing around with the software, I actually just found out that you could create a snapshot. So a snapshot is like it'll basically freeze in time. So let's create one, for example. Let's do master class test. And let me see. What is this? Where is it? Oh, okay. So we could, if I was to, let me see, close this out. Let's do revert. Yeah, here we go. Yep. Right, so technically you wouldn't lose your profile per se if you create snapshots, but you could also pause the VM as well. So if I was to pause it and close out of this, and if I was to relaunch the VM, it will come back to here basically. And let's do a resume. So also, let me pull this up here real quick. It's gonna store, so it stored my virtual disk right here, the snapshot, and this is the disk image file right here. So you should be all set from there. So you actually shouldn't really lose anything in that case. All right. Let's see. Alec, how about you?
Hey, Ricky. Amika kind of answered my question, but how frequently do you use virtual assistant? Because you don't have to set that up every time, do you? Like once you have it up, it's up, right?
Yep.
I've never used it before. Okay.
Yeah. So you have the option to leave this 24/7, or you could just shut it down. So I'll go ahead and shut this down, for example.
And then you can just load it back up.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Oh. Yeah, so it's right here. You just pop power back on.
Okay. All right. And you use that pretty frequently then, or no?
If you see here, I've used this for to track my classes. My most recent one here, this is from Hack the Box, actually. This is their VM. And yeah, I took a Kali class, so this is the Kali VM I downloaded and stuff like that. So
okay, so that's just get the download that on, or you found that, I guess, on online or something.
Yeah, online. Yep.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yep.
Do you use this like for do you use not like this, but like vCenter or vCloud Director for work or anything?
No, actually, when I started my virtualization journey, this was the first one I've started with. I started with VMware Workstation. But yeah, I have heard cases where you could use vSphere and vCloud and stuff like that for servers. Yeah, so that's cool, actually. Yeah.
So. Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to try this for because I'm on Windows 10, I wanted to try it for 11 and see if I really want to get into it. Because I usually don't do, you know, the first out of something, I don't usually do it. I wait till all the bugs are gone. I thought, I could try it on a VM, see how it works. See if I like it.
Oh, and if you want to, you actually don't have to buy this program. You can always download this for free, actually. The VMware Workstation Player.
Okay.
And of course, other programs like OracleBox and stuff like that too.
Yeah, that's what we use in the course, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very cool. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. Excellent job.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great, great, great. All right, next up, Thomas Johnson, are you ready?
Yeah, can everybody hear me?
We can.
Yep.
All right, perfect. So, let me get my screen shared here. Okay, can everybody see my screen?
I can.
Yep.
Yep.
Perfect. So, funny story, Ricky and I almost gave the exact same presentation. thankfully, we happened to be talking in Teams, and he was like, yeah, I'm doing virtualization. And I was like, yeah, me too. So I pivoted. Instead, we're going to kind of piggyback on what Ricky showed everybody, and we're going to take a look at Metasploitable. And Metasploitable is a virtual machine that is designed for you to be able to hack into it. So just a quick rundown real quick of what we're going to do. We'll go over exactly what Metasploitable 2 is, leveraging virtual machines to create your own hacking lab. And then we're going to do a live demo on my PC of attacking Metasploitable 2 with a Kali machine. So what is Metasploitable 2? Metasploitable 2 is a virtual machine that was created by Rapid7. It is based on the Linux operating system, and they designed it to be as vulnerable as they could get it. So it's basically been put out there as a target for ethical hackers to practice on. Now, how can you leverage that in order to create your own hacking environment? Well, just like Ricky showed with his virtualization demo, we can create our own environment that's isolated that we can hack in. So how do you set that up? We're going to be working in VirtualBox, which is another virtualization program similar to VMware. I'm familiar with and use both, but I know how to do the network settings a little bit better on VirtualBox, so that's what I did the demonstration in. So to start, you're going to download the VirtualBox program, which I put the link to it up there, and you're going to want to download the Metasploitable 2 and a Kali Linux VM. Kali is another flavor of Linux. There's a bunch of different Linux operating systems out there, but it is one of the most common ones that's used by security professionals for penetration testing and things like that. And of course, I have the link to the Metasploitable 2 machine from SourceForge and the Kali Linux machine directly from Kali. The cool thing about Kali Linux is if you go on their website, they actually can give you virtual machines that are tailored to the program you're going to run it to. The one that we're going to be using today is one that they specifically made just for VirtualBox. You can actually just download it. As long as you have the VirtualBox program up and running, you can just double click on it and it pops right up. You don't have to do a lot of setup on it, which I thought was really cool and really convenient. So once you've downloaded your machines, you're going to want to go in and change some settings on them before you boot them up. So let's see. Can everybody see the manager there?
Yep.
Okay, perfect. So before you start them, which I have mine running right now, that way they didn't have to take time to boot, you're going to want to go to Settings, Network, and you want to set it to Internal Network. And you can name your network here. Just write down what you name it because you're going to use it in the next part that I'm going to describe. And what that does is it creates an isolated network that is limited only to the virtual machines. They can't even communicate with the host machine that they're on. If I tried to ping any of these machines from the command line on my Windows computer, it wouldn't go through. which is awesome. That way they're completely isolated. You don't have to worry about anyone getting to them, and you don't have to worry about you know being able to get out to the internet or anything like that. They're completely cut off. In security, we call that a sandbox environment. So just set that, and you can see down here I have that set on all three of these machines. Now, before you boot them up, the one thing you'll want to do to make sure that they can talk to each other is to create a DHCP server on your host machine. And I have the commands actually for a Windows machine listed out here to do that. First, you'll change to the directory where VirtualBox is, and then you just type in that command, and you can do it verbatim. You'll just replace where it says insert network name here. That's where I put in my hack lab. You'll create your server IP, which can really be any IP address you want. Just make sure that the IP address you put here, you use the same network and subnet information for your ranges. You'll set your lower range and your upper range, and your subnet mask will pretty much always be the same. And then you enable. Now, the reason that we do that is so your host machine will assign IP addresses to the virtual machines that you just created so that they can talk to each other within your isolated network. But again, they can't talk to anything that's outside. Your host machine, you can't go to Google, you can't do anything like that. All they can do is interact with each other, which gives you that sandbox environment. If you get stuck, Network Chuck has a great guide on YouTube for this. I put the link there at the bottom. Full disclosure, I used it to help me get this all set up. That's where I got the command from, because I wanted to make absolutely sure it was isolated. The reason being, these machines can't connect to the internet at all. You want them completely cut off because you do not want them to be accessible. Metasploitable 2 is a vulnerable machine. It's designed to have security flaws. So if it's connected to the internet and it's accessible from the outside, then it's vulnerable to attack. Someone else could attack your network and use it to bounce off and get in. So by isolating it and creating this cutoff hacking lab that you have now, you don't have to worry about that. They're not reachable. If you do need to connect your attacking machine, which is the only one that I would recommend to connect to a network, you just go back to the settings in VirtualBox. Where did it go? There it is. And just change that setting back to NAT here in the network department and reboot it. Obviously, you'll want to shut the machine down, change this setting, and then restart it again. And then you'll be able to access the internet. And that's if you need to download a tool or updates or something that didn't come with the virtual machine image that you have. I ran into that actually with this machine itself. I had to reconnect it to the internet to download Nessus. We're not going to be using Nessus. I just wanted it on there for my own purposes. But so let's demonstrate this. Let's go ahead and hack something. So we're going to pull up the Metasploitable 2 machine and our Kali Linux machine. And on these default machines that you download, the passwords are usually very simple. For the Kali machine that we're running, it's the username is Kali and the password is Kali. So while that's booting up, let's go over to the Metasploitable machine. So this is pretty much all we're going to do with this for the most part is just have it up and running. Now, how we're going to approach this is just a standard network scan for security vulnerabilities. Like say you're at an organization somewhere and someone comes up to you and says, hey, I think there is a machine on the network that has some vulnerabilities. Can you scan it for me? So first we're going to use Nmap, which stands for Network Mapper. It is a scanning tool that's going to check this machine that we're going to run for any open ports, and then we can use those open ports to see if there's potential vulnerabilities. So first we're going to nmap scan the network, which is 10.38. There we go. Now this is assuming that you have the network information first, which you would if it was an internal penetration test. So we're going to start it. And this does take a minute. That's the worst part about cybersecurity for me is you have to be patient. If you are terribly impatient, you can just hit enter and it'll give you a percentage. So we're 62% done. So this actually scanned because I have a third virtual machine running in the background. I wanted to show an example of scanning a network. So this is the Metasploitable machine that we're looking at. And you can see this has a bunch of ports open. That is a red flag right there that something probably isn't terribly secure on this machine. Because if you look at the other one that I have running, which is another vulnerable virtual machine, it has way less ports that are open and visible for scanning. So now that we know this one is the one that we're after, the 10.38.1.11, we're going to nmap just that one machine, but we're going to do it a little bit differently. We're going to use some different switches. We're going to scan it in aggressive mode, and we're going to check it for services that are running, and we're going to have nmap run some scanning scripts against it to kind of help us look for vulnerabilities and see what's going on. We'll run that. Like I said, this is the worst part of cybersecurity, is being patient for these scans. Imagine if you were scanning an organization with 100 different hosts on it, how long that could take. Okay, we're about there. Okay, so you can see using the different switches in nmap, which is basically just another way of saying the different scanning options, we've got a lot more information. It shows us what ports are open, the service that is running on it, and even the version of that service that's running. And this is all just surface level scanning. You can hit any machine that you want to with this. It's not, strictly speaking, legal, which is why we're doing it in our isolated hacking environment, but you can see the level of information that we've got going on this machine. It even gave us down here at the bottom, it gave us the computer name. It pulled Metasploitable out, gave us the local domain. This really gives you a lot of information to work off of. So let's go ahead and attack this. Now, what we can do here is we're going to open up another tab. And we're going to bring up the Metasploit console. Metasploit is a network scanning tool. And really, it's like a whole framework because it has a bunch of exploits and everything pre-saved into it. And you can draw against it to find different ways to compromise a machine. So we'll do a simple one first. Just going to copy that. And now that we're in the Metasploitable console or Metasploit console, we're going to search. And we're going to paste that service and version number that was running. Whoa. Sorry, I get a little click happy sometimes. Okay, so it automatically searched. And you can see here that there is an exploit that we found in the system that it could potentially be vulnerable for. So we're going to do use zero. And we do need to look at the options because you do have to tailor the attack a little bit. And the only thing that we have to set here, because you can see it required, is only on our hosts and our port. All that's saying is you have to specify the port number that you want to attack, which we got that earlier. That matches with our scan. And you have to specify the our host, which is the target host. So our target host will set our hosts to 10.8.1.11. And let me just double check that that is the one that we wanted. Yes. All right, so now we've set our hosts, and all we have to do here is exploit. And it's running. We are launching an attack on that vulnerable machine. No, it does that sometimes. Something with a virtualization, sometimes it doesn't immediately get the shell. There we go, I found it this time. Okay, we know we were successful because it says command shell session one open. So now we can do print working directory. So that little slash symbol says we're in the root directory, which in a Linux system, that's basically means we're in the administrator directory. We can do who am I, which is a Linux command that tells us we are root. So right now we've compromised this other machine and we can do anything to it because we are the root user on this machine. So what we're going to do here, since we have this information on what the main login and everything is, we can actually switch users and go msf admin. And who am I? MSF admin. So now we can ls, which just lists all the files and directories there. We're going to change directory to home, msf admin, ls again. And oh, anyone who's done try hack me, you know what that is. That is a capture the flag. So we're going to cat, which means it allows us to read that text file in the terminal environment. And look at that. We've got our own flag that we put in there. I put that in there earlier. But that just shows you how you can use this Kali machine that you've used to compromise Metasploitable to view a file on that machine. Imagine if that was, you know, the Etsy password file, which has all the password hashes. Or I'm sorry, the Etsy shadow file, which has all the password hashes. You can really use this as an example of how to get information off of a compromised machine. And we can even close out of that one. Just because we have... How am I on time? Do I have time to do another one?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a bunch of different exploits you can do on this Metasploitable machine. And there's actually a list out there of them. So I should have gone to that slide earlier. Whoops. So just kind of in summary, you can see that by utilizing these virtual machines and programs like VirtualBox or VMware or whichever one you prefer to use, you can set up a isolated, safe environment where you can attack vulnerable machines and get real-world experience using your skills in an actual network environment. And it's legal because you're attacking your own stuff. And just some useful links here. This is VirtualBox's guide for your network settings. This is the exploit guide from Rapid7, the people that make Metasploitable 2. And then if you just want some more info on Metasploit or Nmap, you can go to those. And that's it. Does anybody have any questions?
Nice stuff.
Yeah, excellent job. That was great.
I try.
Yeah, just teaching my interns how to hack again. Thank you very much.
To be fair, half the people in here are in cybersecurity right now.
I know. Yep. So, yeah, I didn't put any stipulations on these, so it's okay, but we teach everything, right?
Yeah. Disclaimer, do not use these skills for evil.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Do not try these at home.
try them in your isolated hacking lab, not on someone else's computer.
Right. There you go. Well, thank you so much. Any questions? Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much. You did a great job. Thanks for showing all that. Very smooth. Our next presenter is Victor. He's covering biometrics.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
All right, let me share my screen. Can everyone see my screen?
I can.
Yep.
My presentation is on biometrics. Because of an increasing number of network security data breaches and identity thefts, stronger authentication systems must be implemented almost everywhere you go. Biometrics technology is used for the identification and an access method for identifying people under surveillance. Biometrics can also be defined as the automated recognition of individuals by means of unique physical characteristics, typically for the purposes of security. It can be unique physical characteristics used in the automated recognition of individuals, typically for the purposes of security. Also, the application of statistical analysis to biological data, and the branch of statistics that deals with data relating to living organisms. There are several different types of biometric authentication techniques. Facial is the most common type. There are lots of techniques used to look at facial characteristics that wouldn't affect the significance of, say, age, expression, lighting, or other variables. A face template is made when applying facial algorithms to describe the shape of an appearance of facial features, like your eyes, nose, and mouth. Fingerprints, another type, a common type, are formed by raised papillary ridges on the skin surface. The ridges themselves do not always run continuously because of the breaks and deviations in their structure. A fingerprint on each human digit is unique and can be used to identify individuals. We also have finger geometry, which captures features such as the shape and surface area of each finger, its length, width, thickness, and the distance between the fingers. Hand geometry is similar to finger geometry, but also includes the surfaces of the hand itself and its side profile. Images are taken while the hand is kept palm down on a support plate and in position by the use of guided pegs. The length, width, thickness, and surface area of the individual's hand is measured and recorded. And finally, odor. It's primarily used for research. Example, an olfaction device, which is used to detect and capture human odors for analysis. We also have DNA, or the genetic code for replicating cells. It's still being researched at this time. They are showing that there are differences that lie between identity management, medical research, and genealogy. Ear identification has been used for many years in countries like France, for example. Ears reveal specific characteristics like shape and other features that allow for identification of an individual. An example includes an arrested person's ear collected alongside their facial image and fingerprint as part of a criminal record. There's three parts to the eye. You have the eye iris recognition technology, which uses the unique patterns of the colored tissue that form the iris. You also have, or these patterns are captured by a camera operating in near infrared wavelengths. Then there's the eye retina, which is fed by a network of blood vessels, and it is this network that forms the unique structure that facilitates retina recognition. Then you have eye sclera, which is the white part of the eye, and when the eye turns either to the left or the right, a network of veins is displayed. It is these two networks in each eye, the left and the right side, that are used for sclera vein recognition. These images are captured with a standard camera, infrared light, or a common smartphone. We all produce a distinct heartbeat, regardless of their heart rate or exertion. Distinct factors include shape, size, sounds, and the heartbeat, the arrangement of the heart, valves, and the pressures that produce the individual's general physiology and health. Only the electric signature of the heartbeat is transmitted and received within the biometric system. The actions with regards to keystrokes, The actions involved in typing on a keyboard can be used to identify the typist once a reference session of their typing has been recorded for comparison. There are two types of biometric signature: static or offline signature recognition, and dynamic or online signature recognition. Offline signature recognition is the graphic image of a handwritten signature of a person, and it is recorded as a digitized reference template. Online signature recognition are the physical actions involved in writing a signature that are captured usually on a screen-sensitive device like a tablet or recorded electronically. Different characteristics involve rhythm and varying velocities of forming each letter, the overall signature, the pen stroke, stylus pressure, and the direction of the stroke, including a free stroke, like crossing a T or dotting an I. Then we have vascular or vein recognition, which is a very new recent biological technology, which is still being researched. The arrangement of veins in fingers and hands form a unique pattern that it can be used to identify an individual. This pattern of veins is captured by shining a near-infrared light source through the finger and recording the image on a CCD camera. Finally, we have voice technology. It is the result of a combination of distinct attributes like the length of vocal cords and the shape of the throat. Distinctive behavioral attributes include your accent and how you speak. The human voice creates wavelengths that can be measured. It's collected and analyzed by software that employs AI and machine learning techniques to produce a vast array of data derived from factors like your speech, tones, accent, and frequency. Biometrics as an authentication. Biometric systems is a combination of authentication, verification, and identification principle. Identification usually asks, who are you? Verification asks, is there data associated with you? Authentication asks, are you who you say you are? Biometric authentication's aim is to verify that you are who you are supposed to be. When scanned attributes match templates stored within a database, obviously the person is allowed into the system. Biometric verification can conclusively prove that their online identity is linked with their real life identity. And then biometric identification can be applied to digital and physical scenarios. It's a solution that is used in the Department of Defense, law enforcement, and border control. There are databases that control or that contain physical characteristics of a vast number of people. The FBI's repository stores height, hair color, weight, eye color, scars, and even tattoos of over 70 million criminal records. Biometrics in the workplace and in the environment. Here we look at the future of biometrics. There are industries out there that use biometrics. However, many companies still resist to this technology. They see little need to collect fingerprints and eye scans or use facial recognition. How is this technology used in the workplace? Fingerprint collection, for example, is common in financial services and government. iScan technology is a tool used in high security industries. Individual photos are taken more frequently in many workplaces and are used to create company badges and identification. PCs, USBs, smart cards, door locks, and shared devices like printers have enabled smarter and more secure access control in the workplace. Biometrics has been supporting organizations in accommodating hybrid, remote, and flexible work arrangements for their employees without exposing them to increased security risk. There is a rise in biometrics because there is a greater awareness of regulation of privacy. Companies must clearly communicate and obtain prior consent from an employee before information is collecting, before information is collected, disclosing where it is to be stored and for how long. Facial scanning technology will be the next wave of biometrics to be deployed in the workplace. Facial scanning technology is already part of the background screening process in the form of identity verification. When we look at public spaces, TSA, for example, hasn't been exploration of biometric technologies and is scientifically driven. They've been capitalizing on significant advances in biometric accuracy, speed, and the ability to automate processes to move passenger through screening. Facial matching, digital identity, and facial identification technologies play an important role with TSA checkpoints. When you look at banking, Wells Fargo has been trialing eye scanning technology. When we also want to look at biometric technology within hospitals as it is crucial today. We have been seeing more where there has been a mix-up with patient files. It has been common where incidents and these happen in hospitals, where hospitals can't, they're not able to keep the data in line as far as the patient's name and their date of birth. So that's definitely something that they do have to work on. And then finally, we look at biometrics and AI. What is AI biometrics? Biometric technology uses unique traits of a particular part of the body, like your hand or face. What AI does is it transforms these traits into code and make them more complex and easier to understand for the system. A person's typing rhythm, walking pattern, voice, for example, can be recognized to verify a person using AI biometrics. How can AI transform biometric authentication system? AI and biometric ID validation work together in the following ways. First, AI-powered keyboard dynamics can identify people with the help of dwell time, speed, and fight time. AI systems can track information about the most frequently used keys to identify individuals. There's also AI-powered facial recognition, which uses 3D biometrics for successful face detection of a person and learning from millions of images. AI can analyze the picture of an old image and create a younger image. AI-powered voice recognition is another, and can train biometric systems using millions of voice samples of different users. Voice patterns can be analyzed, such as speed, accent, tone, and pitch. Recently deceased musicians and actors are examples of this. We also have AI-powered gulp detection, which shows it is possible to detect the movement of a security perimeter of an airport or in healthcare to detect certain diseases. And then finally, is AI smarter? Although biometrics are trusted for accurate authentication, advanced technology like AI can be used to help and deceive the system. AI and biometrics are formed to create a secure biometric system. This combination can help to develop secure systems that can be used to mitigate risks and fraud. This concludes my presentation. Do we have any questions?
Wow. Very cool. I didn't know there were so many properties in the eye that they can actually use for that.
Yeah. The iPhones now have the face recognition.
Yeah. Yep.
I didn't know there was that many different biometric stuff. That was pretty cool. Fascinating to learn about that.
Yeah. Very cool. Good. A little bit more information about protecting ourselves since we just learned how to hack. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent job. Okay, now we have Ashlyn. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All righty.
How do I show my presentation?
Go up to the top right of your screen and click share.
Okay.
And then choose a screen that has your presentation on it. And if you're going to have something that's going to have audio with it, you want to turn on the pop it open.
Can you guys see my screen?
Yeah, you want to toggle the include computer sound if you're going to have something with sound on it, other than yourself.
Oh, no. It's just me.
Okay. All righty, go ahead.
Thank you. So my presentation is on autonomous vehicles, hacking, and insurance, how they all relate, and the concerns regarding all three. Self-driving cars have revolutionized the transportation industry before our very own eyes. From greater road safety to save costs and improved efficiency, autonomous vehicles can assist with it all. With the use of high-precision technology, such as sensors, cameras, and algorithms, self-driving vehicles can view an environment with a 360-degree range compared to humans who only have 180. It has the ability to detect their surroundings and make quick, real-time decisions with its driving assistance and crash avoidance systems, removing the risk of human-related errors, which account for 94% of all traffic accidents. Examples of this are distracted driving, delayed response times, and fatigue-related accidents. With these vehicles being interconnected with each other and in constant communication, they can use this to optimize the flow of traffic and reduce congestion by maintaining consistent speeds, efficiently merging in the traffic, and avoiding sudden braking, leading to an overall smoother form of transportation. They can also optimize routes, reduce idling time, and even increase lane and parking capacity. Autonomous vehicles can also cut costs relating to transportation expenses. With its integration into ride-sharing services, it reduces the need for individual car ownership and supplements public transportations. As we can see on this chart, there's a continual increase in the number of autonomous vehicles on the road, with a 16% increase every single year. In 2021, there was an estimated 39.6 million self-driving cars on the road, but the numbers are projected to be 54.2 million by 2024. Though it's important to note that there are varying degrees and the level of autonomy in these vehicles, such as minimal assistance to partial, high, and full automation. Despite the many benefits that come with the self-driving cars, there comes a warranted number of safety concerns. Although these vehicles are known to have quick response times, it may not always be accurate. These cars heavily rely on their sensors, and there can be many factors that can obstruct it. These vehicles use a combination of sensors, including LiDAR or light detection and ranging sensors, as well as their cameras, radars, ultrasonic sensors, and other technologies. Things that can obstruct these sensors are low light conditions, reflective surfaces, weather conditions, dirt, debris, and especially damage caused directly to the sensor. They can also be incorrectly calibrated, resulting in data discrepancies. These factors can affect the vehicle's ability to react effectively and appropriately to their surroundings, decreasing their situational awareness. The result of this is a false positive or a false negative, meaning it can either detect obstacles that aren't there or fail to detect obstacles that are. This will cause the vehicle to act inaccurately by means of making sudden movements without cause or fail to move at all, therefore crashing into the obstacle. This event is not impossible, as it's happened before. For example, in 2018, An Uber driver used an autonomous vehicle, but it failed to sense a pedestrian crossing the street at night, resulting in their death. There are numerous examples of self-driving cars with sensor failures. This brings up yet another safety concern, the lack of real-life scenarios and circumstances that are too difficult to replicate during its rigorous testing process. Its algorithms haven't yet addressed all possible events, including rare and unpredictable ones, making it difficult to rely on the car's ability to make decisions in these scenarios. System failures are another likely possibility, resulting in another yet safety concern. Because there are so many components that make up these vehicles, it can be difficult to rely on the proper communication amongst them all. Software bugs, glitches, and failures in its fail-safe mechanisms can all result in the vehicle's ability to properly detect and respond to their surroundings. Aside from technological safety concerns, autonomous vehicles also carry the possibility of cybersecurity threats. These cars contain highly complex systems that rely on various interconnected components like sensors, control units, communication networks, software algorithms. It leaves too many possible points of access to the possibility of exploitation, which can result in the compromisation of the vehicle's control, data, and passenger safety. Once unauthorized access is gained through the exploitation, the attacker could have full control over the vehicle's systems, therefore manipulating its steering, braking, acceleration, and GPS abilities, not only endangering the passengers, but other road users as well. This can cause unexpected and dangerous maneuvers, the disruption of the flow of traffic, and potential collisions and accidents. Autonomous vehicles are also susceptible to data breaches, leaving the passenger at risk of identity theft and other violations and threats. These cars can collect information on their passengers to operate efficiently. The information that it collects of their passengers are their location data, driving patterns, names, contact information, communication data, preferences, payment information, even biometric information, depending on the vehicle. Due to its complex systems and interconnected components, like its control algorithms, perception systems, and decision-making modules, it can present the autonomous vehicle to the possibility of vulnerabilities and exploitation of such. Like any other device, autonomous vehicles need to be regularly updated and patched to remove the risk of being an insecure target. Because these cars are so high-tech, there is an option to update them over the air, meaning that fixes and features like firmware, software, and encryption keys can be delivered wirelessly. The problem with this is that it can be susceptible to exploitation, allowing a way for hackers to intercept the exchange and inject unauthorized or malicious software, similar to a man-in-the-middle attack. The vehicle's communication networks and systems can also be spoofed. The communication signals between the vehicle and another device can be jammed, disrupted, or even manipulated by a spoof signal to control its perception of its surroundings. Hackers may also attempt to manipulate the sensor's inputs by generating false readings or misleading the vehicle's perception systems, leading to incorrect object detection and other potentially dangerous driving situations. These two result in a remote control takeover, as it allows the attacker to override the car's autonomous functions. These cars are also prone to DDoS attacks, ransomware attacks, and malware and viruses. So as I was researching this topic, I found this picture that really represents other cybersecurity threats that autonomous vehicles may face. As you see here, attacks can be conducted on connected and IoT devices. Communications, GPS, and sensors are points of access for attacks and spoofing, as previously mentioned. A DDoS attack can be referred to as a botnet on wheels. Ransomware is an interesting one, as attackers can refuse the passenger's access to the entirety of the vehicle until a demand is paid. So they won't even be able to get in it or even get it functioning until that's done. A ransomware can be personal to the users or an entire fleet of public transportation or an entire manufacturer or supply chain. I've touched base on the possibility of carjacking and over-the-air update attacks as well. I had to include insurance in this presentation because I find the topic of it interesting as it relates to cybersecurity. Of course, insurance agencies need to consider all possible threats, but the one that has them stumped is the possibility of cybersecurity risks, making it very difficult for them to provide comprehensive coverage for their customers. Autonomous vehicles are relatively new, and as we can see, it's on the rise and doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. Because of its newness to the transportation industry, there's not enough historical data for insurance agencies to refer back to, making it difficult to estimate the likelihood and severity of all its possible threats, but especially the possibility of cyber attacks. As mentioned before, there are varying levels of autonomy these cars can provide, so this makes it difficult for them to assess liability. If there is an accident, do we blame the human behind the wheel, or is it the autonomous vehicle's fault? In the result of a breach, does the liability lie within the stakeholders, the manufacturers, software developers, or the vehicle owner? With emerging cybersecurity risks, how can an insurance policy be flexible enough to adapt to the threats without being too costly for the consumers? These are all types of questions that insurance agencies have to think of and consider. Although it seems like risks are plentiful with autonomous vehicles, it is still in the early stages of development, meaning there is still a lot of room for improvement. Insurance agencies, technology providers, and regulatory bodies will have to collaborate on addressing these challenges posed by autonomous vehicle risks. This allows the ability to share data sets and even encourage partnerships. The collaboration of research institutions, industry experts, and the investment of insurance agencies will allow ongoing research in order to comprehensively assess all possible and unique risks, to identify all vulnerabilities, and properly analyze accident data. Basic cybersecurity protocols can be implemented to defend against and mitigate the possibility of some of these threats through intrusion detection systems, strong encryption and authentication protocols, and secure mechanisms when updating over the air. Regular software updates and recalibration of sensors could be useful too. I'm sure going forward, regulatory frameworks will become more defined to allow adequate cybersecurity measures and effective liability frameworks. Autonomous vehicles have proven to be a transformative shift in the automotive industry, but with careful consideration and continuous development, the collaborative efforts will hopefully address all these possible threats, including technological and cybersecurity ones, and the possibility for a comprehensive insurance coverage plan to be provided. These are my references, and that is all.
Excellent job. Wow. I did not know that. Of course, that's all new when it comes to autonomous vehicles. So,
yeah. So speaking of which, I don't know if you know this or not, but you can actually go to moralmachine.net and actually start judging scenarios for this specific purpose. It gives you like moral dilemmas, like do you hit, you know, three older people versus one child, or, you know, just different scenarios that play into the decision making of an autonomous vehicle.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's called moralmachine.net.
That's okay, terrible.
That's cool. Let's check
it
out.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Of course there's something like that. I mean,
well, it's all like it's purpose, like, you know, to feed those algorithms, right? You know, yeah. these they need to try to mimic, you know, human, you know, thought reaction as closely as possible. But like,
right,
a lot of the scenarios that I came across were do you hit these people or those people?
And yeah, it's like, none. I mean, if it's playful, okay, but wow.
Yeah. Okay. It's like, no, I'd rather take my card to the wall and not hit anybody. Right,
exactly. Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Excellent job. Definitely good. I love you guys in these presentations. They're great. All right. And Margaret Medina, phishing attack. We've got another. It's okay, all cyber.
Let's see if we can share this.
Yeah.
You guys knew it, didn't you? I'm sorry. Annika, did you have a question for Ashlyn?
Well, I just wanted to ask her if she came across any. I suspect this might be hidden for whatever reason, but any state-sponsored or otherwise attack on these sort of self-driving vehicles?
Oh, it worked.
I haven't came across anything, but I was reading a couple articles and it got me interested in the topic, so I started doing some research and realized it's all connected. But I don't have any personal experience, no.
How do I do this? Because cool. I've never done this before.
So you go up to the top. Well, I see your screen.
Okay. Oh, because I can. It's not okay. I think it's.
Yeah. Do you have your arrows at the bottom, 1 through 8 there, and then or just click your screen? I think moves it forward, right?
Okay. This is what is phishing? Phishing is a type of cybersecurity attack that involves when malicious actors sending messages pretending that they're a trusted person. They can manipulate a user and trick them into installing a virus or clicking on a link that they shouldn't, or even giving away their credentials. Do you know how to tell the difference between a phishing email versus a real email? Anyone? You can all answer if you like.
The spelling.
Okay, I'm going to show you here. Can you tell if, I don't know if y'all can see this or not. It's kind of small. Can you tell if this is a real or fake email? Can you see the email?
I see the, oh, okay.
That's fake.
Yeah, that's fake. Right. If this is Best Buy, why is it fashionlab.com?
Yeah.
I get that same thing with American Express. It's always something different.
Okay, and then there's one more. How about this one?
Yeah, that's fake.
So something on this one, how would you know with something like this?
Well, for this one, it's because they're telling you that you won a certain amount of money.
Oh, well, okay, that's fake.
On this link up here where it says right. Click the view. So it's kind of giving away, how did I win money if I didn't remember entering into anything?
Right, exactly.
Definitely, like, the lack of punctuation.
Yes.
Yeah, really look at, and spaces between things, and typically it's written in wrong English.
Yeah.
Sometimes even if they're Australian, it's wrong English.
Sometimes people don't really take a minute to look at it. They just see, I won money. Okay, cool. I want to do that. But they don't really take a second to figure it out. Wait, what did I sign up for that I won money for? Because I don't remember. They just think they won money and then they automatically click on it. And then it brings them to a site where the hackers get all their information. So how it all started was the first attack started back in the mid-1990s. It was by a hacker spammer named Con C. Smith. He was credited to have the coined term phishing. And apparently AOL was one of the AOL users were the first ones to get phishing attacks in 1990. A group of hackers, they posed as AOL employees and they used instant messaging to email the users to steal their passwords and hijack their accounts. Because, you know, back then we really didn't know that much about phishing attacks. So people just fell for it. And I'm guessing AOL was the easiest because you always have that little dial tone and you remember how to get into AOL. I don't really think they really protected themselves that much. AOL didn't really have too much protection there. So they got hacked a lot. And It said phishing attacks, they hit an alarming level with over 1 million in a single quarter, which was recorded back for the first time in 2022. So these are some of the different types of phishing attacks that are out there. There's CEO fraud, business email compromise. That's where like the criminal sends an email to a lower level employee, thinking someone like that's in accounting or finance, and then pretending that they're work for the CEO, they're the assistant to the CEO or another executive, and they trick them into giving some information. The next one would be clone phishing. That one is like they take advantage of legitimate email messages, and they act like the victim may have already received it, and they create a malicious version of it, and then the victim clicks on them, and then they catch them that way. Another one is domain spoofing. They use either email or fraudulent websites. It occurs when a criminal spoofs an organization's company domain. Then another one would be evil twin. That's a rogue wireless access point that masquerades as a legitimate Wi-Fi access point, so the attacker can gather personal or corporate information without the end user's knowledge. And then another one is the HTTPS one. That the attacker uses a variety of social engineering tactics to trick the email recipient into clicking on the link or copying and pasting the URL into their website browser. Then another one, smishing. That's a way of cyber criminals to lure users into downloading malicious payloads by sending text messages that appear to be from legitimate sources and contain malicious URLs for them to click on. And then there's spear phishing. Those use spam-like tactics to blast thousands of people in massive email campaigns. Spear phishing emails target specific individuals within an organization. Then there's vishing. That's occurs when a criminal calls your phone to try to get you to provide personal or financial information. Waterhole vishing. It's targeted by businesses identifying specific websites that your company or employees visit most often and infecting one of them sites with malware. And the last one that I found was whaling. It's similar to the CEO fraud, but it's more they target the higher level individuals like the CEO and the CFO and the COOs. And then how to protect yourself against it. Never provide your personal information in a response to an unsolicited request. Never provide password over the phone or in an email. If you think the company isn't legitimate, try calling them yourselves and to find out if you can see if they actually sent you an email or what the email was and why they sent an email to you. You want to regularly review your statements on all your cards, your information, to make sure that no one's got any information about your credit cards or your bank statements or any kind of statements like that. And don't open any attachments or links in unsolicited emails. And that's the last one. And there's my references.
Great job. Lots of information on that.
Thank you.
Sweet. Any questions for Margaret, from anybody? Okay. Well, congratulations, everybody, on getting your presentations done. They were awesome. As usual, lots of things to learn. I love it. So have a great evening, and thank you so much for your presentations. Thanks for everybody for joining, and we will catch you again on next week. Thank you.
Have a great night.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.